Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline. I'm Karen James. November 11th is Veterans Day, a day to honor those who served in the military, but our returning veterans are also serving time in jail and prison. Tonight, my guests are Dr. William B. Brown and Dr. Robert Stanulis. William Brown is a professor with a PhD in sociology in the Department of Criminal Justice at Western Oregon University. He is the research director of Pacific Policy and Research. Dr. Brown is a combat veteran who served in Vietnam. Since 2008, his research has focused on veterans entangled in criminal justice. Robert Stanulis is a licensed psychologist and neuropsychologist with a PhD in clinical psychology. His current practice is in the area of forensic psychology and neuropsychology. He has worked with veterans experiencing PTSD since the early 1970s, well before PTSD was a recognized psychological disorder. He is on the Veterans Advisory Board at Western Oregon University. Both have worked on numerous criminal cases involving veteran defendants in both state and federal courts. Dr. Brown, Dr. Stanulis, in a 2015 Justice Policy Journal article, you wrote that in understanding or evaluating veteran defendants and their behavior, cultural incompetence may be one of the leading causes of injustice throughout American courts. Cultural incompetence. Explain that term.
Culture refers to how a society communicates. Cultures have their own language, their own symbolism, their own ways of communicating. When you don't understand the cultural, then you have problems. We're seeing that in other areas in the criminal justice system with cultural difference between black communities and white communities. The problem with veterans is we don't perceive it necessarily as a different culture, even though it is. It's highly symbolic with lots of decorations. You can tell a veteran's entire life story by what is on his uniform and the ribbons and awards he's showing, tell you whether he's in combat, everything about him. It has a different language. It says, with lots of acronyms and lots of meanings, as foreign to a civilian as French is to an English-speaking person. If you don't recognize those cultural differences, then you miscommunicate or you miss important parts. Well, the worst thing, since we're talking about criminal justice, is culturally the worst thing for a veteran is to be embroiled in the criminal justice system and to become one of them. These are young men and women who went in with an absence of criminal record, who served and came out after the years most people commit their crimes. And yet now they're embroiled and they become one of them. So they don't want to admit, because of cultural reasons, that they are in the criminal justice system. So often they get missed. And civilians have trouble speaking with them because they don't understand the language and the symbolism that's involved in the veterans' culture.
Explain the military culture that is indoctrinated into every soldier. Dr. Brown?
Well, essentially, I was thinking here about how to talk about this, and I guess the easiest way would be how I think about it. When I got back from Vietnam, I was assigned as a drill sergeant at Fort Lewis. And since that time, I've looked back and tried to explain to myself what it is I actually did. And the easiest way for me to explain it is my primary duty when we got a new company or a new platoon was to basically reach into the head of the new recruits and pull out the disc. This disc had been formulated by the civilian culture. It didn't fit. It didn't work in the military environment. And our job then was to insert a new disc. And from that point on, you start programming that disc so that they respond, they behave, they think militarily. And, you know, some of the primary ingredients that we would include or topics that we would include in this disc that we inserted is the importance of obedience, sacrifices, duty, and loyalty. And while I'm certain that, you know, some of these have certain values in the civilian world, they have much more stringent, much more importance placed on these values in the military. And in order for a recruit to successfully complete basic training, for example, in the Army or boot camp in the Marines, they have to demonstrate that they've accepted these. And once you've accepted them, then you're moved on, and now your experiences build on these. And this is sort of the heart of the military culture right here. And, of course, the problem arises when they get out. No one looks in the box where that old disc was. And so they're released with this new program disc tailored to meet the needs of the military, and oftentimes it doesn't fit in the civilian world.
How does this military training, which can be acclaimed as heroic and necessary in the military, how does it translate to the civilian culture?
Well, in a word, at times very well, because we know, for example, can transfer well into the civilian world, that veterans who run businesses tend to be more ethical than non-veterans, so it can be positive. On the other hand, it's a jarring experience that we tend to use the word reintegration when it's really reacculturation. One of the big problems we recognize, for example, for the average veteran coming back is part of the military culture is to be part of something larger than yourself. When they come into the civilian world, they find that that's not what civilians do, that their life is not necessarily about something bigger than themselves, that they're literally willing to give their life. As an outcome of that, they tend to gravitate then to things that might be part of them or become estranged and withdraw from general society because they don't have anything that's bigger than them. Sometimes that ends up with them joining motorcycle clubs and other groups that may also place them at risk for criminal behavior, or they withdraw more typically and don't fit in. Many of them, for example, go to college, but many drop out because they can no longer function in a civilian society and they feel alienated. A few years ago, for example, I did a workshop at Western Oregon for the faculty on how to work with veterans, and the divide was very clear. The faculty was afraid of the veterans. The students felt disrespected. It was a culture clash. So that's why I don't use the word reintegration, because reintegration is what you do after you come back from vacation. You go away for 2 weeks and do whatever you like to do and then come back. And I'm a psychologist and you do radio shows. That's reintegration. We all have a little bit of a problem. Cultural is far more than that, because you now have to relearn a new language. You have to realize the people you're speaking to don't understand your language. Your values are no longer the same. It extends into moral issues that we'll talk about later, about moral injury, that what's morally and acceptable and heroic in the military would be criminal in the civilian world. You've been trained to violate the most basic moral thing of all, thou shalt not kill. But in the military, you become a hero, the American sniper. In civilian life, you would be on death row. Mm-hmm. So these values are a very big issue in terms of reintegrating. Incorrect word. It's a reacculturation process.
And you say in your reports that you believe that soldiers returning from war do not reintegrate back into civilian life, and they remain individuals without a cultural home. And talk about, Dr. Stanulis, why the faculty at the university were fearful of veterans.
They're fearful of veterans because they see them incorrectly, as a lot of people do, as trained killers, when in fact they're merely people who were trained to kill under very restrictive situations, the rules of engagement. You've acquired a skill. You're good at it. You're the best in the world at it. But you only use it when ordered to under very stringent guidelines. Yet we perceive them as killers. Part of what ends up happening also is the first question people ask the veterans is, did you kill someone? No easier way to cut off an entire conversation than to ask that question. So this was the fear that the veteran would act out somehow in the classroom, would be dangerous. On the veteran side, it was being insulted, being told they were instruments of war, that they raped and pillaged, being disrespected, being talked in a classroom about what's going on in the Middle East and nobody saying, well, you served in Iraq for a few years. Maybe you have an observation I don't have as an academic. So it's a very fascinating conversation. And I found it interesting that there's all this concern for the veterans, but one of the themes I always see in the veterans coming back, nobody asks them what they're thinking about. Nobody asks what they're concerned about. In preparation for my workshop, for example, I contacted a veteran or two I know, and I said, I want you to go out and ask people, what's the problem they're experiencing in college when they come back? What the veterans were telling me, this is not what I thought, this is what they told me over and over again, the lack of respect, feeling alienated. They were not only chronologically older than the other students in the classroom, they were different because they had seen more and done more. They were more mature, but they also didn't fit in. They were struggling with being around crowds. Many of them have PTSD, so being in a classroom was a problem. The feeling of not being respected. And obviously, if the professors are feeling fear, you can easily see why you would feel disrespected. After all, you say, I serve my country, and yet you're afraid of me.
Mm-hmm. And how did you approach that with the faculty, with the professors?
I approached it from the point of view of pointing out that one of the unique problems we have with veterans is they're now a unique 1%. Unlike the Vietnam era, where all cultures, all ages, everybody got drafted, now we have 1% of volunteers who are very cut off, a very small subset. And pointed out to them as professors, you're also 1%. Only 1% of people have PhDs. And you too are in some ways cut off from the larger culture by your education. You have your own culture. And that perhaps you could empathize with the difficulty of being in a 1% category. And maybe you could start a conversation there of how hard it is to be in 1%, whatever that may be, whether it's a 1% athlete. Small groups have to learn to communicate together because they do have different cultures and different beliefs that get reflected in political ideals as well.
The returning soldiers from our more current wars, Vietnam and Persian Gulf and now Afghanistan and Iraq, they are seen more as baby killers with My Lai, the massacre at My Lai, more so than the vets from World War I and II.
Well, I think you have one uniqueness, which is the current generation. Remember, if you entered the military at 18 in 2001, you have spent your young adult years, you're now 33 years old, and you've been at war or preparing to go to war every day of your career, and it's been a hot war. Very, very different. We also tend to idealize it. World War II, the greatest veterans, they didn't have PTS. We forget we did 10,000 frontal lobotomies on people for PTSD. We forget that when Saving Private Ryan was shown on network TV, the VA hotlines lit up. And it was all the World War II veterans who were re-experiencing their PTSD from the trigger of watching the opening scenes of Private Ryan. We're forgetting that right now, the biggest group that's approaching the VA is the Vietnam-era veterans as they're retiring, and their ways of coping with PTSD are being taken away as they retire, and their symptoms are reemerging. So every war gives you PTSD. This war has another signature injury, which is traumatic brain injury, because of the IEDs and the exposure to concussive blasts. So we're also seeing a population of people who would not have survived in other wars, who are being saved, but also have traumatic brain injuries on top of their PTSD.
And Dr. Stanulis, you are a neuropsychologist who has worked with veterans experiencing PTSD since the early 1970s, again, well before PTSD was recognized as a psychological disorder. Is PTSD the most common mental health diagnosis among veterans?
PTSD and TBI are the two most common ones. Traumatic brain injury, TBI. They're often hard to distinguish because they have very similar symptoms. They involve the same brain areas, so memory problems, attention and concentration problems. There's often a great deal of symptom overlap between the two. The other one we're seeing is major depression. And of course, the biggest behavioral problem, the biggest outcome of mental health problems is an incredible suicide rate.
Do only military men and women who experience combat suffer from PTSD?
No. For example, obviously there's a sex difference. There's military sexual trauma, a euphemism for rape and sexual abuse within the military. It happens to both men and women. I have seen men, And I have seen women. So there are other things that cause PTSD. Sometimes people who don't serve in combat become very psychologically upset for not pulling their weight, for feeling like they're not doing their part, that they're not living up to the culture because it's a warrior culture. You trained to be a warrior and to not go into combat can be a problem. It's a form of the survivor's guilt you see in post-traumatic stress disorder where I should have been part of that. I didn't do what I was trained to do.
And watching close friends die in front of you?
It's a very common one. It's part of the moral injury. One of the stories I frequently hear when I do evaluations is, why did he die? He was the one with a wife and children. I was the single guy. He was twice the soldier I was. How come I didn't die?
Now, Dr. Stanulis and Dr. Brown, you both do research in moral injury, which is recognized as a substantial issue that requires specialized treatment. What are the symptoms of moral injury and how is it treated?
Well, for me, I try to simplify the definition of moral injury. And a little bit ago, Dr. Stanulis touched on this. You go into the military with a certain set of values that have been implanted before you enter the military. And these are part of the civilian values. One of the predominant ones, of course, would be, you're not supposed to kill anyone. It gets even more complicated or when you add to that, if you're a male, you're not supposed to harm a woman. You're not supposed to harm children. But in a war zone, you don't really get to choose what you get to do or what you have to do. And in the war zone, again, going back to those values of survival and loyalty, where you have to, you're forced or required to do things that violate the values of the civilian world, you engage in those types of behaviors. I'm not going to talk about it, but I'm a guilty person in that from my Vietnam experiences. And what I know is when you come back, if you remain in the military for a while, you can sort of shrug it off. It doesn't really bother you. But when you leave the military and now you're a bona fide civilian / veteran, and you listen to people talk, you read newspapers, you read magazines, see movies, whatever, and you come to the realization that, wait a minute, that was wrong. So who am I? Oftentimes what this does, it's very much similar in my view to a lot of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. You tend to isolate yourself. You don't want to be around people. Dr. Stanulis mentioned, I know in the client interviews that I've conducted over the years now, and non-client interviews, the most prevalent question that veterans are confronted with by friends and relatives is, did you kill anyone over there? And once this happens, this sort of is like a trigger for, in my view, moral injury. And you have this tendency to want to back away because there's actually two of you now. The one who received awards or possibly a promotion in the military for doing this. And now you mentioned the term a little while ago, the baby killer. So who are you? And that's the problem for a lot of vets, is defining who they are, because they did what they were supposed to do. On the other half of them, how could you possibly do that?
There's another part of that as well, is we have some research definitions of moral injury, which is doing or failing to do something that violates your moral codes. So it's associated with being involved in the death with civilians, being involved in the death with non-combatants, women and children. But it's also facing what human beings can do to one another. So imagine, for example, how do you live with seeing how awful war is, where your job is to go out and pick up on all the hands out there and fingerprint them so that we can identify who was blown up in an IED. So very often what you hear is, I don't know how I can live with myself when I see that part of human nature. That gets into the next problem, that soldiers are trained to find and kill the enemy. And when you have moral injury, you become the enemy. So what do you do with the enemy? You eliminate it. So it's a factor in suicide. You ask the question about the treatment focus on this. It's incredibly different because moral injury incorporates part of PTSD, but it's different. And we know the treatment of it is extremely different. Treatment for PTSD is to relive the trauma, learn to feel not feel anxious about it, learn to manage fear. That's exactly the opposite of what you want to do with moral injury, because moral injury is not merely repeating the bad things I did. It's coming to philosophical, spiritual, existential peace with it or ability to manage it. So it has very large treatment things, because the wrong treatment could exacerbate, if you haven't, the symptoms you're trying to manage in a treatment program, because you have to know what you're treating. And the treatments are exactly opposite.
And let's talk about the mental health providers and the evaluation of the veterans. Now, you explain in your articles the need for cultural competency when addressing PTSD. But what specific questions should a culturally competent clinician ask a vet?
Well, one of those would be, first of all, what are your experiences in building up the rapport? And understand there's going to be reluctance to talk about that. It's understanding they have to be very careful when you're dealing with PTSD to not just stir the pot and leave the person anxious and agitated as they walk out the door, and being able to get them to relax and calm down. It's understanding the language. It's understanding if you're a civilian treating a veteran, there's not an automatic connection. There's all going to be a belief because you're a civilian, you can't understand the veteran's culture. And of course, that's true. So it's often a miscommunication which becomes the whole issue because of not seeing it as culturally different. Again, the examples, if somebody came to you of a different skin color, speaking a different language, you would be saying, well, maybe I'm missing something because I don't speak the language, and this is clearly a person of a different culture, and I better pay attention.
And Dr. Stanulis, Dr. Brown, you say in your reports, to a vet, guns are teddy bears and a source of anxiety relief.
Because yeah. that's what you were trained with it. It is the quote-unquote, and actually I think Dr. Stanulis coined that term, which we use. But, you know, a weapon is, that's part of the survival. It becomes your best friend in the military. And, of course, it can be exasperated when you take into account what the individual's MOS or military occupational specialty was. If you're infantry, a weapon, a rifle or a handgun is much more important than, say, if your MOS was a clerk. So, again, this is ingrained in these veterans, and it's very difficult to break away. On the other hand, everyone is not the same. I got out of the military in 1973, and I've never touched a weapon since. But we've had clients that live with weapons. You know, they sleep with them. You know, their trunk is loaded with weapons. So again, it's kind of the individual and I guess how you deal with this on your own level. And plus, some people are lucky and some people are not so fortunate.
And I want to add with that, the term teddy bear came from a veteran. And he says, you want to understand. Well, if you think about it, what saved your life in combat? When do you feel safe? When your weapon works. All soldiers are taught on some level, the most important thing you better take care of is your weapon. So, of course, having it around you reduces your anxiety. Now, back to the question asked about cultural competence as a treatment provider. If you know that, you can assess symptoms and how bad a person is suffering by asking a question. How many guns do you own? Where are they? Oh, you took your guns out of your car and put them in the gun safe. Oh, the gun that used to be on your pillow is now in the drawer. Sounds like we're making some progress. So you can use it as a way to assess how the person is doing, because it works the other way. The guns come out of the gun closet. It's gone out of the drawer next to the bed. It's under the pillow. What's going on? So these are the kind of cultural clues. And, of course, you can see where some civilians would be appalled at the concept that owning and being around a gun reduces anxiety. But if you understand military experience and culture, that this is the most important tool you'll ever own, this is where you'll be the safest, it makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So let's turn to culturally incompetent district attorneys, the judges, our court system. How does this affect the prosecution of veteran defendants?
If you lack an understanding of the military culture, you really have no constructive way, at least in my view, of trying to find an explanation for the alleged criminal behavior. A person, you know, say for example, is in a bar, the typical bar fight, and someone touched the veteran on the back. Well, the veteran is drinking, and for whatever reason, he turns around and he strikes the person who touched him. You know, well, in the civilian world, it's pretty easily explained. You violated the law. You assaulted. You committed assault and battery. But for the veteran in that situation, it was an instantaneous reaction, and they reacted. I'm not saying that it should be excusable, but at least someone should have some kind of vague understanding of the explanation for the behavior. You know, clearly that veteran needs some kind of treatment, or maybe more than anything, he should stay the hell out of the bar. You know, but it happens. And when you ignore those factors of trying to explain behavior, and all you look at is the behavior itself, in my view, I don't see anything constructive about that at all.
And what does a culturally competent district attorney or judge look like?
Well, it's somebody who asks the question. We book in 4,000 to 6,000 veterans a year in Oregon, so it's not an unusual thing. And I've heard judges be upset and say, I don't want to find out your client's a veteran when I'm sentencing them. I'd like to know before then. It is difficult because the criminal justice system has its own culture, which tends to look at whether the behavior that is being looked at is criminal or not, and not particularly look at how do I explain that. Where it really meets the road is at sentencing, however, because one of the things we know, we gave the example of the alcohol-related problems. Well, PTSD causes alcohol abuse, substance abuse. But what you see in presenting to you as the district attorney is an alcohol-related offense. If you don't take the trouble to find out, and this makes obviously the burden in the criminal justice system is on the defense attorney, that's the person who tries to explain behavior. But it has to be received by the district attorney as an explanation rather than written off, well, that's just an excuse. So very often what we see is the presenting problem, just like in a clinical practice, that symptom may not tell you all you need to know. So you have to look and go beyond the story and say, well, what causes this? What caused the drinking? And particularly in substance abuse, we don't like to do that. Again, a cultural problem in Oregon, for example, substance abuse is considered a personality disorder. All the scientific addiction medicine, that it's a brain problem, that it is not a moral failing, that's not a personality disorder, was explicitly rejected in the Oregon criminal justice system. So that's how prosecutors think. This is a personality disorder. This is a moral failing. It's not a brain problem. And that's where you have to educate and say, whoa, you've got to deal not only with the substance abuse, you have to deal with the PTSD. Mm-hmm. Well, when you're already biased against it, when you're already thinking of substance abuse as all only can be a moral failing, you're going to miss it. And it's not just for veterans. I think we have to be very clear that that's one of the problems in the criminal justice system. We also then have people who prescribe treatment for that. And sort of one of the funny things that happened around the country is in New York State, they had to pass a law saying judges could not practice medicine because they would only allow abstinence-based treatment programs for substance abuse and not allow any other treatments that are much more effective. And so they literally had to pass a law. So you can see that where it becomes one's cultural. Mm-hmm. And when you're in the member of the criminal justice, that's the lens you see. Is this a crime? What's the penalty? It's not particularly necessarily oriented towards explanation. And that will be the most frequent question that I get asked. So you're making an excuse for the veteran. No, I'm not making an excuse for anybody. I'm educating to what the causes are, to the explanation, to what needs to be addressed to get what we all want out of the criminal justice system, rehabilitation, and no more recidivism.
Mm-hmm. And let's go back to the judge. You mentioned that the judge says, I don't want to find out that the defendant is a veteran when I'm at sentencing. You write in your reports, in your articles, that veterans are adamant about not using the military as an excuse for illegal behavior. Is this part of the problem?
It can be. Veterans find this embarrassing, you know, that here I am, you know, I'm a soldier, I'm a Marine, I was in the Navy or the Air Force, you know, and I served my country honorably, and now I am, I'm here, I'm a scumbag. You know, I'm standing before the court. I'm an embarrassment to the military. And so some vets are apprehensive about even revealing their veteran status. On the other hand, there are some defense attorneys who don't even bother to ask veterans or their clients, are you a veteran? In my view, I think that it requires a defense attorney to work much more diligently and much harder if they find out they do have a veteran client. So, you know, you're caught in a way of most veteran clients are indigent clients. So, you know, how much work do you want to devote to this and you want it to distract from your paying clients, you know, your high-priced clients? But we have worked with some attorneys here in Oregon that are exceptionally good, and we've gotten outstanding outcomes, not just for the case, but for the veterans themselves. I mean, I don't know. Dr. Stanulis and I have shared numerous cases here in Oregon, and how many recidivists have we had?
To our knowledge, we haven't. Now, obviously, we have some who are locked up forever, but we've been very fortunate so far that many of the times this becomes the wake-up call for the veteran, because they're basically people who lived well before they went in, because you can't get into the military if you have a significant juvenile record. You can get a waiver for some things, but it's not going to be anything besides a minor in possession or something minor. You're simply not going to get in. Veterans are pro-social going in the military, serve during the prime time of 18 to 24 when people commit crimes. So they're starting later, and there's good explanations. And we've been fortunate when we've been able to get them into treatment pre-trial or get them into a diversion program that we've had a very high success rate to our knowledge. We're not aware of anybody who's failed.
Prosecutors in Oregon have the discretion to recommend diversion programs that allow for treatment and deferred prosecution. What other deferring types of programs are here in Oregon?
Well, the primary two laws for veterans in Oregon are, one, the diversion program, where at prosecutorial discretion for certain crimes, they can recommend a diversion program. And if the veteran completes that, then that's no longer a conviction. We've used that in a few cases. It's allowed people like in the National Guard to stay in the National Guard by resolving their charges that would otherwise get them booted out. We also have, by law now in Oregon, your veteran status can be used by the sentencer as a mitigating factor to lessen the sentencer.
And explain that.
Well, for example, we just recently did a case of an individual with a very bad alcohol and drug problem that resulted in a lot of robberies and burglaries to support his habit, with very bad PTSD and a traumatic brain injury. And by working with the Veterans Administration and what's called the Veteran Justice Outreach Coordinator, we were able to put together a program and persuade, I guess would be the correct word, that we had a treatment program available, that going to prison, you would not get treatment. In fact, we'll talk about that in a minute, about what doesn't happen in the Oregon prisons. But this was able to give the judge the opportunity to look and weigh at how much more time in jail. He had been in jail for about a year. Should he sentence him to more time in jail? Or did we have a program that would address his post-traumatic stress disorder, his alcohol and drug abuse, and his traumatic brain injury? And with the Veteran Justice Outreach Coordinator, that is designed to work with individuals in jails and prison, we were able to put together a program, do all the appropriate evaluations to define those problems, and a treatment program for each that's going to last literally for the rest of this man's life, but certainly very intensively for a year or two, and be able to present that this is what he needed to prevent recidivism. And the question for the judge is, when you're going to do that? Is it something you delay and sentence him further, or is it something they say, I've got to do it sooner or later, sooner is better? And so at times we've been successful in defense attorney's been successful in using our opinions. And I think it's important to point out that I simply form an opinion about people and defend that opinion. It's the defense attorney who defends the client. And we're just providing information to use to try to find the most appropriate sentencing. Part of the problem we have when to finish this and that story is that we don't have any treatment in the Oregon Department of Corrections for individuals with post-traumatic stress disorder. In fact, it's the policy of the Department of Correction to not treat people with post-traumatic distress disorder. they regarded as too dangerous in testimonies of the state legislature. So
explain that, Dr. Stanulis.
It's hard for me to explain. I can only say what they have said, that in April of 2015, there was a proposal on Senate Bill 780 to provide dual diagnosis treatment for a very small subset of Oregon prisoners. It's a year-long substance abuse program for low-level offenders. And the proposal was made that we should identify the veterans in there and treat their PTSD, since PTSD, as you heard me earlier, causes the substance abuse. So it was meant to be a pilot program. Obviously, I testified in favor of providing that treatment because PTSD is a deadly disorder. And again, we forget that with mental health diagnosis. We forget they're medical disorders that kill people. They're not just merely making you uncomfortable. And the testimony was by the Oregon Department of Corrections is that they would be too vulnerable and be victimized or extorted by other inmates. So they were against the treatment. So this is part, again, of, for example, in the case I was talking about, is recognizing that if you're a veteran and you go into the Oregon Department of Correction, you will explicitly not be treated. That delays your treatment. That places your life at risk. As we also have to recognize in Oregon, if you're a veteran under 45, the leading cause of death is suicide, and that's associated with PTSD. Oregon veterans account for 8% of the population and 24% of the suicide. So this is a very serious, untreated medical problem. Other places do the treatment. Florida's been treating PTSD and having special veterans units.
In their prison since
2011. Wow. Now, Oregon does have one veterans unit out at Snake River facility, a 72-bed unit that the veterans worked with the Department of Corrections to set the program up. But it's not a treatment program. It's certainly better than nothing, and certainly self-help works with veterans at having people of the same culture helps you get through. But for other people, they'll never get treated. We have had people who are serving life sentences or very long sentences, and they will never get treatment for their PTSD.
So 72 beds at Snake River Correctional Institution for veterans suffering PTSD, substance abuse, mental health problems, and out of how many vets are in the Oregon Department of Corrections?
Well, I think we're looking at 14,000-something. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but the data that we received from the head of the research department at Department of Corrections here in Oregon, doing the math, 19.1% of all prisoners are veterans. So you're looking at well over 2,000 veterans. In the prison system, and you're right, 72 beds, they have a little ways to go.
Yeah.
And we have to remember that 72 beds are not treatment beds. These right. are simply beds that you get into because you can prove that you were honorably discharged. It provides no treatment program. Most mm-hmm. other places provide not only living with other vets, but a treatment program because of the high rates of mental health disorders in veterans. That's how they got there.
There is one other thing that I would like to say and make certain we get this in here. I've had well over 100 clients, probably about 140 clients since 2008. And I think it's important to discredit the view of a lot of people, and that is that these are bad apples. Out of this 140-plus cases that I've had, I've only had a slight handful of cases where they did not receive honorable discharges. So most people have this idea that, wow, they were bad, they were court-martialed, you know, they got undesirable or less than honorable discharges. That's false, at least from my experience, and this is around the country. This is not just in Oregon.
And this is very incredibly important to point out that this is one of the costs of war. Crime rates went up after the Civil War. They went up after World War I. Increased crime rates is part of the cost of war. And also to add that, Dr. Brown's being modest, he actually did a very explicit study looking at veterans who were involved in the criminal justice system versus veterans who were not. And the difference was some got caught and others did not. And it gets explained away not as a cost of war, but as a selection error. These guys are in the criminal justice system because they never should have been in the military. That simply is untrue. And again, just as PTSD by some other name has been described back as far as we have written records, it's a cost of war. So is criminal behavior afterwards. It's part of the moral injury. It's part of the fabric. And so on a larger issue, we have to recognize that when we fight wars, we don't only end up with PTSD. We don't only end up with moral injury. We end up with societal problems. And there was a judge in Eastern Oregon in a murder case that said it best. He looked at the defendant and he said, "We sent you overseas to keep the violence of terrorism there. And ironically, you brought it back to us in small town Oregon and the United States."
Dr. Brown, Dr. Stanulis, thank you so much for this very important conversation about returning vets and their involvement with the criminal justice system. I've been speaking with Dr. William Brown with the Department of Criminal Justice at Western Oregon University and Dr. Robert Stanulis, a clinical psychologist and neuropsychologist and well-recognized expert on PTSD. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you for being one of the few people actually interested in this.
And this is Prison Pipeline on KBOO, Portland. Good night.